If you ever hear that thunder, put your eye to the sky, boy, and wonder. Maybe there's a kingdom above the weather. Oh, and whether you're gonna get on in is up to you. If you ever hear that crying in a distance like some siren, maybe there's a singer with no ring around his little finger. Oh, love. And if I lose my voice, if I have no choice but to go quiet, won't you sing for me a melody into the night there?
Oh, man, I could listen to Mavis Staples just any time. Having her sing is just amazing, and we're going to listen to several tracks from her brand-new album, which is called Sad and Beautiful World, and it spans 7 decades of the American songbook, and she has these reinterpretations of timeless songs. She's a legend, and we'll be listening to Mavis Staples. So the music break's coming back in. Will probably be longer than normal. I'm just warning you. Good morning, all. Welcome to the Roundtable. It is our Friday edition, and I, for one, cannot be more happy just to have you all here in the same room. Not to mention the fact that, yes, it's Friday. It's the 21st of November, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome you to be a part of the program as we always do. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. O-R-G, and you can be a part of the discussion. We have a lot to discuss this morning and all kinds of things going on, so we'll get to that in just a moment. Let me introduce everybody to you, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich, currently teaching at Middlebury.
Yes.
Yes. Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. We also welcome the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. A little sad. The Bills lost.
That was a tense game.
It was, and I got up at 3:30 yesterday morning and took a train to New York, so I was like nodding, you know, as I'm trying to stay awake for the game, and then finally I was just like, it's just time to go to sleep.
Yeah.
I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. I was hopeful there, and then the wheels came off the bus.
Yeah,
but it was fine.
You need these. You need these losses kind of in the middle of the season to really light a fire and get them in ship shape for the playoffs.
I don't know which is more incredible to me about this current football situation that we're in, which is that the Bills have lost 4 games or that leading the division is the New England Patriots.
I used to a long time ago like the Patriots because Dick McPherson was the coach, and he was a former Syracuse coach. And so I did root for them for like 1 year, but or 2 years, however long he was there. It wasn't long. But other than that, I just, no, I'm sorry. I've been a Bills fan since I was a kid, so I grew up in Syracuse.
But you know, the thing about the Patriots, and I don't have any really, unlike a lot of people, I don't have that much ill will toward the team. And I, in fact, there are times where I really enjoyed and had fun watching the team. But they were just so god-awful last year.
That
to turn around, it's like, oh, this is pretty cool. That's kind of
fun.
Well,
you know, maybe they're back to their old ways.
Recording plays and deflating the
football. And I don't know.
All right. Excellent. Welcome to Sports Talk 90.3. So nice to have you with us this morning. We welcome Siena University Professor of Economics. Aaron Pasitti is here from Siena University. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great because for the first time, I was able to see the Northern Lights, not with my naked eye, but by taking a picture of the northern sky last night. And it just, it's going to make my month. It's so wonderful.
Oh, it sounds like my time could have been better spent.
Yeah. No. Or you could just become an Eagles fan, and that would solve the problem.
Well, I live with an Eagles fan, so yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
I was telling you this, but about a week ago, I was coming home from an event and saw the Northern Lights, and it was I didn't know such a thing. Yeah. I've never seen them, and I just it was otherworldly. It was very cool.
Yeah, and we didn't have to travel north of the Arctic Circle in the winter to see them.
Yes, that's exactly what my bonus.
So your first thought was not somebody must have put something in my drink.
Yeah.
No.
No.
All right. That's been on a bucket list of mine for a long time.
Not the drink part, but the Northern Lights, not having
PCP and a beer or something, seeing the Northern Lights.
Yeah.
Someday I'll tell you the story about being roofied at our family reunion.
Oh, wow.
I
can't wait to hear it.
It's a good one. We welcome, we're thrilled that Aaron has brought three students with him. Three Siena University students. These are all majors in economics from Siena University, and we are thrilled that they are here. Aaron has been bringing us students with him over the last several weeks, and they add so much to the program, and we're thrilled they're here, and I'm even more thrilled that they're the future of this country. Will you please join me in welcoming Kylie Castellana? Hello, Kylie. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here. How are you?
It's really exciting to have you here. So tell me what your game plan is for life.
So I'm a senior now, and after graduation, I'm planning to complete my MBA at Siena still. And I have a finance internship lined up for this summer, so I guess we'll just see what comes from that.
Oh, good. You already got the internship. Mm-hmm. Good for you. And where are you allowed to say where?
Yeah, GE Vernova.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thank
it
you.
Sounds
congratulations.
Like
you
got
Thank
the
you.
You got the plan there. That's good. Wonderful. We now move on to Micah Moore, who is with us. Hello, Micah. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show today.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the program. Give me a sense of what year you're in.
I'm a senior as well, doing finance and econ, enjoying both. Thank you to Dr. Pasidi, who actually got me to try econ in the first place, which has been pretty enjoyable since then.
How did you get him to try econ?
Back rooms. Arm
twisting, putting stuff in his drinks.
Yeah. Econ. And then the hope to do, the hope moving forward?
Well, I'd like to, after school, I plan on eventually going to get my master's. But right now I'm focused on studying for my CFA, and then we'll see what kind of avenues that opens. Trying to keep a bunch of open doors for opportunities to see what's out there. Definitely really excited, though.
Where's home base?
Like, where am I from?
Yeah.
I live in South Colony, actually, so not too far.
And you were?
New Paltz.
Okay, New Paltz. Yeah. All right. We're also welcoming Andrew Kirk to the program. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for asking. What year are you in?
I'm a senior, and I'm graduating in May.
Oh, man. All three of you are got to be really excited. Because the minute you come back from holiday break, it's done. You blink and it's
done. Don't say that.
You know it's true.
It's the truth.
I think I have most of them in my class next semester. So.
Even more so. what's the hope? What's the plan?
I don't know the exact plan for after college, but I do know that I would love to keep working for the SUNY Research Foundation. I really love the team there. I love what I'm doing, and I love supporting higher education research.
Wow. What are you doing there?
I'm a data and market research analyst.
Okay, so like, what would when you have to describe when people say, "Oh my God, go get Andrew," they need you for what?
They need me for anything. I do it all. I do it all. Specifically, it's probably to schedule a meeting and to get a subcommittee together. That's probably what I do the most.
All right. Well, I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Congratulations. You're all fine, fine examples of the students. They, I was going to say churn, but I think that's a derogatory term. Right.
Hey, hey, hey! I'm on the board of the SUNY Research Foundation. So,
oh no, yeah. I meant Siena.
Oh, okay. But, I thought you were disparaging us.
No, no. I don't know if you all know, but my father was a Siena alum. It's always been a dear place in my heart and in our and my life. And so I'm thrilled that you're all here, and I thank you very much for joining us. All right. With that underway, let's go to the news at hand, and there is quite a bit of it. I don't know if you've noticed. And I guess one of the things that we should start talking about here is, let's see. Oh, we just have a few moments before the break, so this we won't take long on this story, but in just a little bit, the President of the United States will be meeting with Zoran Mamdani, and they'll be meeting for the first time. Certainly implications there for New York. And this is going to be interesting for a lot of reasons. It's going to be interesting. But the president will schedule to host the mayor-elect at the White House this afternoon in a meeting that will be closely watched after the two men have repeatedly attacked each other. Mr. Mamdani sought to play down the potential for conflict and spoke about trying to find common ground with Mr. Trump on issues like bringing down grocery prices. I believe, and this is at a time when the president has also truth socialed the saying, going to have Kwame Mamdani in my office today. So sort of sets the tone there. Mm. After months of trading attacks, President Trump and the mayor-elect will meet at the White House. Their relationship will be interesting. It could be hugely consequential for the nation's largest city. And here, and this is a line from the actual New York Times article that I'm reading right now, but it's the understatement of the year, the dynamics are complicated. Heather, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, wow, I would love to be in the room for this meeting. I think Mamdani has proved that he can be very charming. And I'm told that the president can also be charming. But I also think we've seen shades of other temperaments, actually from both of them. But I think that the advice that he's gotten from others who've interacted on a longer term with the president is probably good. Be respectful. And, you know, I don't think that he's going to just roll over and decide to give up his sort of progressive ideals because he's in the room with the president. But it's going to be interesting for sure. I think politically there's probably no really good ending here of this meeting, only because there's too much potential gain for the president in the midterms, using Mamdani and the prospect of a, I think he calls him communist, but actually socialist mayor, is something that will, they're hoping, help the Republicans in the midterms. So I don't think he's going to do anything to roll out the red carpet and give him a glide path that will make life easier for him. They do have points of agreement, though. I mean, I think affordability and some of the sort of ham-handed solutions that are at the same time progressive and also populist, like having the government take over, I mean, certain aspects of the private sector as a solution, they may find some agreement, but I think that would be a very long, windy conversation to get there. So I look forward to seeing what comes out of this.
As do I. Aaron.
I disagree a little bit. I think Trump has everything to lose and Mamdani has very little to lose. Everybody knows what Trump's capable of, and he's already did it on Truth Social, as you notice, or as you mentioned. I think it'll be very interesting to see how Mamdani, he's slick, and the Trump playbook is out there, and people know how to play it effectively. And I think that Mamdani is a very different type of leader that's having a meeting with Trump and has perhaps less at stake than perhaps some bad-mouthing or having the federal troops sent in which is, you know, likely going to happen one way or the other. But I think that, you know, I think Trump's a little frightened. I think he's looking for an opportunity because of the thrashing in the midterms, the weakening economy. Pick your, you know, pick your story of how the country is starting to lose faith in the president. I think he's trying to save a little bit of face. And I think Mamdani knows that and is going to play into that. So I think coming across as a sane, progressive alternative could actually attract a lot of moderates who are upset with Trump and perhaps swing them to the Democrat side for the 26 midterms.
There are some really interesting psychological dynamics here because they're looking at each other, Mamdani and Trump, and they see each other as populists from the left and from the right. Even Steve Bannon has grudgingly admitted that he finds Mamdani to be absolutely fascinating and that he's a very talented figure politically. I think I just like to follow up, Aaron, what you said, and Heather, you know, just sort of bring out some of these aspects, you know, of the, you know, the push and pull that's probably going to take place between the two because they both need each other. On the one hand, Mamdani doesn't want to completely antagonize the federal government. Why? Because the federal government has already withheld $18 billion in infrastructure funds, right, for New York City. So that's one thing. But Trump, on the other hand, you know, has overplayed his hand. By withholding that money, he's antagonized people living in New Jersey who commute to New York. And quite possibly, as a result of that, the Republican candidate for governor lost to Mickey Sherrill. All right. All those kind of independent voters and sort of kind of perhaps slightly right of center voters in New Jersey who were planning to vote for the Trump-supported candidate decided that that was kind of a losing proposition. Their life would not be made easier as a result. So I think that it's going to be, it's a kind of a 50-50 confrontation is what the way I see it.
I was interested. There was a line in the New York Times coverage that said, they're talking about Mr. Mamdani and saying, he has been known to disarm high-powered skeptics with charm and a willingness to listen and engage. But if he treats Mr. Trump with kid gloves, Mr. Mamdani's backers may feel that he has betrayed his progressive roots. That seems to be playing a little too, putting a little too much into it, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems to me that there's also an understanding that both men probably are just trying to get through it.
Well, I think that Mamdani has already been criticized for doing what I think is a very smart thing, which is staffing up with people who understand how this the city budget interplays with the state budget and the federal budget. I mean, the budget of the city of New York is staggering, and the holes in their budget are many. A lot related to transportation, but, you know, they've got they're trying to operate in an environment, and he's trying to do things like make, you know, create more affordable housing when he's got a city council that at every turn is going to pass legislation that makes affordable housing more difficult to accomplish. And in order for him to push them, he has to push them in a direction that his base doesn't want him to push them. So he's really in a tough spot as far as any move he makes, he's going to be subject to criticism. So I don't think he can walk out of there going, you know, I really like the president. We had a great conversation. And, you know, but I think Trump on the flip side, and to sort of be contrarian to what I said before, as much as he would love to see an example of a complete and abject failure of a Democratic, progressive Democrat, he also is from New York. He loves the city. He made his, you know, he grew up in the city. He's got properties there. I think, you know, there was a thought a while ago was that he was going to come in and try and fix the city and try and make things better. So we've got a lot of conflicting motives and a lot of people looking really closely. And, you know, I just don't think there's a lot of room for gain for either of them. But on a real policy level, maybe there is.
Anybody else want to jump in?
Yeah, you know, kind of going off with what you were saying there, I think what we've seen with Zoran, and even when he first kind of announced his run to be New York City mayor, kind of coming out of nowhere almost as a new candidate. And honestly, for my younger generation now, at least, you know, being in college now and starting to kind of see a whole lot, to see a new candidate or see someone new, basically, is really, really interesting to see and learn. And then I would kind of go with, I think, the insulting, the ways that we're on breaks Trump's playbook is I think he's almost gotten stronger as Trump has tried to criticize his policies or criticize, you know, any of his actions. I mean, that's really kind of from, you know, the way I just have looked at it, he's just gotten stronger and more people have come to support him. You know, and it's that almost breath of fresh air that's really relieving. But, you know, I think it is a game, you know, not really a game, but, you know, you have to play your cards right of, you know, how can you negotiate with the negotiator, President Trump, and then also still be able to, you know, support the policies that you had proposed when making your election run.
I think too, not that the mayor elect is coming into this meeting with a mandate, but he did win with over 50%, and he took down a really large field of a lot of candidates. So there is that, and there's a little backup there.
And that's the same thing Trump did in 2016.
Yeah.
An outside candidate with little history that's taking down very established and very well-financed names. So, you know, just despite the fact that they come from very different sides of the political spectrum, there are a lot of similarities in terms of being outsiders, in terms of being a fresh air, like Micah said. They're talking about the same issues, affordability, the populist message. Mm-hmm. But it's also important to remember that a lot of campaigning is just political theater, right? You're establishing a plot. Mm. The actual governance is very, very different. Mm. Very little of what politicians talk about gets enacted, or it gets enacted, you know, the horse is a camel drawn by committee or whatever that saying is. So, you know, Nobody gets that?
Does anybody know that?
Oh, no. My favorite is you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him brush his teeth.
Okay.
Well, that was actually a quote from a state senator, very, very...
Oh, that's a good one.
Long-standing state senator. I always thought it was funny. I don't know what it means, but...
A camel is a horse designed by a committee.
There it is. So, you know, you propose, a free bus fare, you propose rent freezes or something... Maybe a very watered-down version of that gets through where he can claim victory, but it's probably not going to be anywhere near as expansive as what he was promising in the campaign.
But for their base, neither of them can come out and say that they enjoyed the meeting. I mean, I think they're...
But see, I...
I think so. Okay. I think that, I mean, people don't want to be... There's expectations on the side of the base, and people are very strongly opinionated. And the base that elected Mamdani is not a base that supports Trump. Trump's base does not support Mamdani. So they can't come out and say, oh, we're best buddies.
Gross.
Although they're the two people who might just do that anyways, right?
So, like, very quickly, I just want to jump in here, to develop a little bit some of the things that you just raised, Heather, which is, you know, the asymmetry or like the way in which, you know, there's really no kind of belief-based overlap between these two people, you know, in spite of the fact that they have a populist style. I will say that the political language that Trump uses is so limited. People, when he criticizes Mamdani, when he, Caroline Leavitt and Pete Hegseth and Russell Vought and others use this epithet of communist, this means nothing in the present moment. You know, what are we referring to? North Korea and Cuba, you know, which have very little to do in many ways with the communist, you know, systems of the Cold War. So the message that Mamdani is giving people is just much more wide-ranging and inclusive. And the political language that Trump uses is from a different era that doesn't speak, I think, now to the vast majority of, correct me if I'm wrong, the young people who are here, it doesn't seem to me that it speaks, you know, to the vast majority of people who are, you know, below the age of 40.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, Trump's generation, Trump's era calling someone comrade is like a huge insult. And right. I think for someone who's under 40, it's like, what?
You know, it's a massive shrug. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Anyway. Anyone under 40 want to weigh in on that? No? All right. You brought up an interesting point at the very beginning when you were talking about both these men are populists. What does that say about us?
I think it says that, you know, we are frustrated with the political traditions that have kind of inhered in the two-party system, and we want outsiders. You know, it doesn't have to be a third party, but it needs to be somebody who is carrying a message that is a little bit, you know, less binary, you know, or at least in terms of the, you know, in terms of the party system we have. It would be great if we had something like the party system of, I don't know, I'm just off the top of my head, Germany, France, or Israel, where, you know, you have several different parties and they have to form a coalition government depending how, you know, the vote comes out. We don't have that here. And so it's basically winner takes all. And we no longer have a kind of a sense in which the binary of left and right is actually sometimes obscured by the two-party system. There used to be liberal Republicans, for example. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that anymore. Yeah. So I think people are just very frustrated with these kind of stark, you know, devil's choices.
We need to blow up the primary system. We need to completely alter the primary system, in my opinion. And we also need to get rid of the way we count the votes in the Electoral College. And I've said this a million times, they need to be apportioned. I mean, if you really want people's vote to count in a state, then the people in the minority in that state, whatever percent cast their vote for they should get that proportional share of Electoral College votes. It would radically change.
Yeah, hear, hear. This is something that is way overdue.
Yeah.
And we could also talk about campaign finance and how that has led to an inordinate amount of money just completely distorting the democratic process over and above the two things that you both mentioned.
Yeah.
So...
Paul is listening to us in Sheffield, Massachusetts, and said, "As I'm listening to the discussion this morning on the roundtable, all I can think of is, what would this meeting be like if Cuomo had won?" It's an interesting point. It is.
I think the motivations coming out the door would be similar. I personally, having worked with the Cuomo, I interacted with the Cuomo administration, and I think it would be a very different conversation. But I think the motivations coming out the door would probably be similar.
Trump and Cuomo are both blowhards who like hearing themselves talk and who like having power. I mean, that's at the base of it.
That was the working title for this show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mamdani, I think, is coming from a different perspective and understands that, you know, macho chest thumping wasn't part of his campaign. It's not how he's going to build a coalition. It's not how he's going to win over voters. So I think he's going to go in with a very different approach. And I think it's going to be a little bit slithery. And I'm so curious to see how Trump responds to it, because Trump is... as Alexander pointed out, he's kind of a one-trick pony, calling somebody a communist or a Muslim, and case closed, dismissed. I think we're dealing with a level of political sophistication in Mamdani that we haven't seen before go head-to-head with Trump.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Heather Mulligan, Aaron Pasitti, Alexander Mihailovich, and our student guests this morning, Micah Moore, Andrew Kirk, and Kylie Castellana. All of that and much more, plus your letters, right after this.
Sometimes I just won't go.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 43 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday edition of the program. Hope you are well. Let's go to this about Ukraine and figure out what is happening here. We talked a little bit about Ukraine, I believe, earlier in the week. And a lot of that had to do with some of the stories coming out regarding corruption. But now let's talk about the U.S. plan. This is from the New York Times. And then we'll go to Alexander first for some thoughts on it. European leaders on Friday warned that the Ukrainian army should not be defanged and that they should be consulted on talks to end the war in Ukraine as they scrambled to respond to a U.S.-Russian peace plan that has largely excluded them and Kyiv. The plan, which was drafted without Ukrainian or European involvement, would require Kyiv to surrender significant slices of territory, reduce the size of its army, and relinquish some types of weaponry, according to officials familiar with this proposal. A spokesman for the chancellor in Germany said in a statement that the leaders of France and the UK had pressured President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine during a call on Friday of, quote, their continued and full support on the path to a lasting and just peace. The statement did not explicitly mention the U.S.-Russian plan, which reflects the maximalist demands that the Kremlin has made throughout the war, which Ukraine has long rejected. The leaders welcomed the U.S. efforts to end the war, but insisted on the need to protect, quote, vital European and Ukrainian interests in the long term. That includes the fact that the Ukrainian armed forces must remain capable of effectively defending Ukraine's sovereignty, and that any agreement affecting European states, the European Union, or NATO requires the consent of European partners or a consensus among allies, and that from the statement that was released. Alexander.
So there are a couple of things here. First of all, some background. This peace, so-called peace plan, was drafted by Steve Witkoff and Kirill Dmitriev, who is an advisor for Vladimir Putin. The Ukrainian government and Volodymyr Zelensky had nothing to do with this. So this was basically just given to them, and they're supposed to accept it. So this is a raw deal, and many of the details are clearly something that, you know, that are drafted by Putin's political party, what they want from Ukraine, which is essentially a kind of a rump state with a political system that is more or less controlled by the Russian Federation, with Quisling candidates and political leaders, and that Ukraine, in exchange for, the Russians would cease to invade the country in exchange for a guarantee, that a promise that they would never join NATO, and that they would have roughly their domestic military, and they would completely be stripped of any weaponry that would have long-range capabilities of hitting Russian targets within the Russian Federation. Those are the specific concrete details. Now, having said that, there are interesting aspects of this deal that actually reflect Russian desperation. For one thing, the original Russian demands were that it would obtain all of eastern Ukraine, which is Donbas, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and of course Crimea. Now they've backtracked that completely, and they are saying only that they are interested in Luhansk, which is mostly controlled by Ukrainian forces at this point. So this represents a little bit of a scaling back of the original aspirations, territorial aspirations of the Russian Federation, which was a full 20%, 19-20% of Ukrainian territory. Now it's maybe, from my rough guess off the top of my head, it's something like 7%. So why did the Russian Federation scale back on some of their demands? Well, I think it's the fact that their military is overextended. They don't have enough men to fight in the army, you know, to take part in the invasion. They're having massive casualties right now. Their military is very poorly trained. They've had this kind of abbreviated boot camp, which means that many of them are going straight into the meat grinder of the war. The Russian technical capabilities with drone, weaponized drones is actually behind the level of sophistication of what the Ukrainian army is using. So in many ways, their situation is not what it was, say, 8 months ago. In terms of their their successes on the field. Now, there have been some limited successes. The town of Pokrovsk, for all intents and purposes, has been retaken by the Russian army. But that's only one victory among a welter of many losses, it seems to me. So it's interesting to see how the Russians are willing to recognize some of, you know, the realistic constraints that they have at the moment.
Why would Ukraine ever agree to this?
They won't.
Okay.
They won't.
Okay.
The answer is that they simply won't, you know. And it also, you know, there are many aspects of the plan that are, you know, completely unarticulated. For example, not only can Ukraine never join NATO.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just bracketing that, leaving that to the side for the time being. No foreign troops of any kind can ever come into the country to assist Ukraine in any sort of territorial defense. All right. However, this plan supposedly has a feature where the United States offers security guarantees to Ukraine, but those guarantees are not spelled out. So they're essentially meaningless. So, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky will never sign this.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, this essentially just tees it up so that you get this signed, you get it behind you, and then Russia can go in again later.
Well, I think, yeah, that's essentially what it is,
yeah.
You know. And you're depriving, you know, Ukraine for self-defense. You know?
Yep.
And but the other aspect of this, which is interesting, it seems to me, is that it's almost as if we've been here before already. From that very first meeting between Trump, Zelensky, and J.D. Vance last February, where, you know, they kind of berated him, and, you know, and Vance, like, really insolently, it seems to me, told him, "You're just faking civilian casualties." When I heard that, the top of my head almost flew off. It's just ridiculous. But the fact of the matter is, they were offering at that point the same so-called peace plan, and of course Ukraine rejected it. It seems to me that what's happening is a kind of an ironic turn of fate, which is the United States is antagonizing Ukraine so much that Ukraine is now naturally turning to its EU allies for assistance.
Right.
So Germany has built up its, you know, its own military significantly. For the first time, Poland is paying a full 5% of its GDP to build up its own military to, you know, to defend itself and to potentially assist Ukraine. Many of the people in the Trump administration have been saying, well, the Europeans should just take care of this themselves. We don't want anything to do with this. The isolationists in the Republican Party are very passionate about that. This is what's happening, precisely what's happening. They're offering a peace plan that Ukraine will not sign, and is simply going to enter into some kind of independent security guarantee with the EU. And so, yeah, the U.S. in some ways is completely peripheral to this. Nobody needs it.
Yeah, in a weird way, Trump ends up with what he wanted originally, which was them to spend more on their military,
right?
The EU countries, not Ukraine,
right? Yeah. So that's happening now.
But yeah. We're ceding our leadership role in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the wild card is Trump's, you know, prickly, you know, crystalline ego, you know, which is that, you know, he wanted to claim this as a big victory. You know, he wanted to be the person who you know, ended this war, you know, who negotiated it successfully with a, you know, built up or beefed up economic relations between the Russian Federation and the United States. It would be a win-win for everybody. But that's not happening. So he's going to be vexed about that. But, he's probably just going to take the loss and say, okay, this is the European problem. Let them deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I heard him disparaging Putin. I was listening this morning and heard him saying something about, well, he's not, you know, I'm unhappy with him or something along those lines. So it's just interesting to me that it doesn't seem like there is a really an abstract peace that can be negotiated with these personalities.
No.
You know, the other issue is that, I'm not sure if this is quite the type of isolationist policy that the U.S. wants. I understand what Trump and his base voted for in terms of the U.S. getting bogged down in long, endless wars that have very costly and ambiguous outcomes. But in many ways, particularly with the start of the trade war, Trump has already economically and is now geopolitically alienating a lot of former allies, including the EU.
Mm-hmm.
So who else will the U.S. turn to? And I mean, Trump's ultimate goal of the presidency is personal enrichment for him and his family, and Russia and the people in the Russian orbit represent a huge source and perhaps an infinite line of credit for Trump and his family. There could be a lot of very friendly and lucrative business deals that could be signed with people who are allied, whether it's Russia themselves or countries that are aligned with Russia politically. I see this part of as a bigger play in terms of how Trump views politics as being purely transactional. He looks at it, the presidency, as just another position that gives him greater power for personal enrichment. And if, you know, getting behind a deal that is, you know, that essentially accedes to the maximalist demands of what Russia wants, then that's a win for Trump, and pushing it off to the Europeans.
But this is a matter of personal enrichment.
Oh, I know. I understand. Yeah, no, I 100%
the Russian
understand
Federation
that.
Now, with the recent tumbling of the ruble, its value globally, is now has less. Its GDP is less than that of Italy. All right, it is not a global player anymore. You know, in the same way, except for some aspects of energy resources like oil and gas. But even that, you know, has been hit hard because of the boycotts, you know, since the invasion of Ukraine, but also because of, you know, green energy and other things and the ways in which, you know, paradoxically, the boycott has resulted in sort of, you know, more aggressive promotion of green policies within the EU, which are, you know, beginning to take fruit. So, he thinks that somehow the personal enrichment that he will experience in dealing with the Russian Federation directly is going to somehow enrich the country. And this is a complete and utter fantasy.
No, of course. Right. No, that's not.
But Witkoff himself, Steve Witkoff, has pushed this to say, you know, if we build up those relations economically with Russia, have, you know, for example, Mobil, former Standard Oil, have, you know, do more prospecting for oil, you know, in Sakhalin Island, for example, in the Pacific, then, you know, how wonderful it would be for both countries. But it's a drop in the bucket, you know, in terms of energy resources, really, and the money that it would generate.
Well, I think, yeah, the protracted nature of the war has forced people who are dependent on Russian energy to find other resources, including liquefied natural gas from the U.S., which is being shipped to Europe. I mean, it's kind of forced new markets, so it makes it harder for Russia to recover on the basis of those former relationships.
Right. Absolutely. I was wondering what some of the other people in the room think about all of this, because it does affect us in many ways, you know, in terms of the price of oil and gas and carbon energy, and to what extent should we rely on carbon energy, given the fact that there are now these other options that could be developed further.
Anybody want to weigh in? Or I can come back to you after the break, because we do have to take one of those. Yeah. Okay. You think about it. And we'll be right back after a break. We're going to get some news from WAMC Regional News, and we will return right after this.
Singing hard times ain't gonna rule my mind. Hard times ain't gonna rule my mind. Bessie, hard times ain't gonna rule my mind no more.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. On the program, we have Alexander Mihailovich, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, currently at Middlebury College, and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. Heather Mulligan is CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Aaron Pasitti is the Siena University Professor of Economics, and we welcome three majors from that university, Micah Moore, Andrew Kirk, and Kylie Castellana. We welcome you as well, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's talk about some jobs numbers. It's November, it's almost December, but we're ready to talk about September, because there was all that pesky shutdown.
Yeah, this is, I think, almost a perfect metaphor for the Trump administration is like moving forward in time, but somehow moving backwards in other dimensions. Anyways, so the first Friday of every month is when the Bureau of Labor Statistics, working in conjunction with the Census Bureau, release the employment report, which is the most comprehensive report on labor market conditions. So the shutdown started on October 1st, and the September jobs report was slated to be released on the first Friday of October, which was October 3rd. So the shutdown prevented the release of a jobs report that was complete at that point. There was no new surveys that needed to go out. The numbers were there. So now we have essentially a two-month delay in its release. But before we get to the numbers, I think it's important to understand that it's not the sexiest topic that I've talked about, but the importance of government data is absolutely critical for how our economy and households and businesses operate. Households might not directly be interested in economic data. Households might not understand why an accurate unemployment report is important. But getting timely information from institutions that are the international gold standard for economic conditions in the U.S. affect how much risk financial firms are willing to take on, and that affects access to credit for businesses and households. It affects Federal Reserve decisions, which affects interest rates on credit cards and auto loans and student loans and mortgages. So not having this data presents a serious problem, but it makes the smooth functioning of an economy very, very difficult. That difficulty is exponentially compounded because the U.S. economy is at an inflection point right now where it's clear based on past readings that the job market has largely stalled. We're seeing rising inflation. GDP growth is starting to slow. And we're expecting major financial firms and the Federal Reserve to make decisions at a critical time when, you know, economies might be tilting towards a recession with high unemployment or a period of runaway inflation without accurate data. So the fact that this data is being released is good, but the bad news is that for the first time in 77 years, I believe, the Bureau of Labor Statistics will not release a monthly employment report for the month of October. So we will have a missing month in that gap. It's not, you know, it's not like missing a year's worth of data, but it certainly compounds the problem. So what happened in September? The U.S. economy added 119,000 jobs. The unemployment rate ticked up from 4.3% to 4.4%. So it's been a stronger monthly jobs report than we saw during the summer, but it's only 1 month of data. If you look at average monthly job growth since Trump took office, meaning from January up to September, the U.S. economy has added, on average, 76,000 jobs a month. That is half the number of jobs needed just to keep pace with population growth and new entrants into the labor force. So just right then and there, even including this month's surprisingly large job gains, job growth has been anemic since Trump took office. And if you take a more refined snapshot and say, well, what happened since the Liberation Day tariff announcements? Job growth falls to an average of 39,000 jobs per month. So we're looking at a labor, no matter which way you slice it, we have a labor market that is grinding to a halt. Job growth is stalling. A quarter of all unemployed workers have been unemployed for more than half a year. And that number has been on the rise since Trump took office. So even though the unemployment rate is low at 4.4%, if you lose your job, you know, there's a 25% chance that you will be jobless for more than half a year. And that has a huge effect on consumer spending, on consumer confidence. So it's only 1 month of data. The past few months of data have been revised downward, so I would expect downward revisions to this as well. And it poses some challenges for the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve is trying to steer the economy through a very, very unprecedented time. They're in uncharted territory where you have the biggest major policy shock in over a century, which is the tariffs and the trade war that the president started. I've mentioned this before. I'll do the summary now. Trade wars coupled with the deport tariffs, which are taxes on imports, coupled with the deportations, coupled with the budget-busting budget bill, are all going to lead to stagflation, where you have rising unemployment and rising inflation. So it's a double whammy for the U.S. economy. And if the Fed tries to stimulate job growth, they're going to stoke inflationary pressures. If the Fed tries to fight inflation, they're going to create an unemployment problem. So the Fed's trying to navigate this very, very delicate balance to figure out how to respond. The lack of data makes it extraordinarily difficult. And if when the Fed met when the Fed met in October, there was enormous dissent in the Fed about, we should raise interest rates to fight inflation. No, we should lower interest rates to fight unemployment. No, we should keep interest rates stable. All this does is heighten those divisions. So when the Fed meets in early December for their meeting, they're going to be making it on very limited information. And normally when you have an economy at an inflection point, one possibility is just do nothing and wait and see how this starts to unfold. So that's the much, much delayed update on the jobs report. And it's not just the labor market. We're starting to see cracks in other areas of the economy. Consumer confidence is plunging. Delinquencies on credit card loans, corporate loans are starting to go up. And there was a Fox News poll that was released earlier this week. Remember, Fox News. We're not talking about, Gallup or somebody else that Trump
could point
to. So
it's more science-y as well.
Right.
I
was going to say it's far more accurate, far more scientific. science-y, yeah. Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Now you made me lose my train of thought.
You're too serious.
I know. Thank you for that. Yeah, I know, right. Like people
brought you down to earth.
You did lose your train of thought. I'm sorry.
No, the Fox News poll showed, and there's a growing dissatisfaction even amongst Republicans in terms of how Trump's handling the economy.
Oh, yeah.
So whether he's lying about the numbers, whether he's disputing the numbers, whether he's firing commissioners, at some point, he's going to have to confront reality. Mm. And, You can't lie about reality. You can't lie about people's grocery bills. You can't lie about...
Yes, you can.
I think he's done that.
Well, you can lie about it, but okay, so let me rephrase that. You can lie, thank you. You can lie about it, but that's perhaps a lie people won't believe. How's that?
Fair enough. Make them look at something else. That is an art form in this administration. Yeah, look over here.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Yes.
I just like kind of going based off of what he just said. Like there was already a lot of uncertainty before the government shut down, whether because of stagflation, because of increasing inflation, increasing unemployment. So the government shutdown definitely came at like a very bad time where there was already uncertainty and now there's even more uncertainty, which obviously is like shown through the decreasing consumer confidence. And I just think it'll be really interesting to see what the Fed decides to do next month. I think that there's a big chance of them just waiting it out.
Andrew.
And to kind of go off what Dr. Pasitti was talking about earlier, the lack of data, just thinking back to our Federal Reserve challenge, we were prepared to have the September jobs report incorporated in our Federal Reserve challenge. But then, of course, the government shut down and we were unable to get that data before we were supposed to submit our challenge. And just based off that, my point being is maybe if we saw this data beforehand, it may have had an implication on our policy, what we would have recommended, our policy recommendation, because we solely were off the belief that the weakening labor market was the big problem going into for policy recommendation. But if we had seen the September jobs report, maybe we would have really taken a step back and thought about our policy recommendation a little bit more. And I think that's as shown what's going on in the Fed right now with the diverse conversation and the divide.
So imagine if you're running a bank or a business. I mean, you're talking about a really fun academic experience. But imagine if you don't have this data and you're trying to, you know, figure out, you know, interest rates, how much credit to extend to different parts of the economy. The other interesting piece that I forgot to mention, because Heather derailed me, was that...
sorry.
All her fault.
He's not really mad, though.
I know. They've announced delayed releases for other reports. The one report they have not released any delayed dates on, which is kind of worrisome and perhaps part of a broader political agenda, is the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation report. There has been no updated date, to my knowledge, of if and when those past months of data get released. That's kind of important for an economy that, because of tariffs and deportations, is experiencing really rapidly rising inflation.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's like what we did with our presentation as well, as we saw, like, you know, we tried to go and break it down. You know, we go with the whole, all of, you know, groceries basically is how it's put it as, and we saw with meat prices drastically increasing. And then, you know, all it takes is you can just do a couple scrolls on your social media feed and you'll see, you know, ICE agents going into our farms or even like a meat plant or something going in to take out all those workers. And, you know, it's right there that we can kind of almost see what Trump's policy implications are having on some of the workers, you know, furthermore, just driving up the costs for everyday goods for families. And, you know, and that goes beyond, obviously, you know, we also have our electricity costs going, you know, drastically increasing recently. And but, yeah, I'll let you kind of go forward.
Well, I was just going to say, too, I said this on the show earlier in the week, but my favorite comment over the last several days was from our Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, who said that the reason that beef prices are so high is because each immigrant who comes into this country illegally is bringing in a sick cow with them.
He said that.
Yes.
Remember, yeah. He's supposed to be the adult in the room.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And no one by the door said, "Sir, you'll have to come with us." Nobody, like nothing. Yeah. It was just like out into the world.
Okay. Well,
yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. No, he's supposed to be the adult in the room. He's supposed to be the person who's got his head screwed on straight, who understands how global financial markets work. And here he is saying this.
Well, I think buried in the text of the article, and I always look at what are manufacturing sector jobs looking like, because the goal of the administration and the implementation of tariffs and trade deals and all of that was we're going to reshore manufacturing in the U.S. And the manufacturing sector lost 6,000 jobs in September, and that is. You combine that with huge loss, not huge, but relatively large losses in transportation and warehousing. Those are concerning. Warehousing, you know, that's where all this stuff gets stored, right? Yeah, right? If there's no need to have employees because there's not that much stuff moving, that's sort of a bellwether of what is to come. There's always going to be growth in retail this time of year because of people hiring up for the Christmas season. So that didn't surprise me at all. But
leisure and hospitality too, because of the holiday travel.
Right, exactly. But when you see losses, net losses in manufacturing, which is a completely contrary result to the stated rationale behind some of the administration policies, that's when you have to pause and take a look and say, month over month, are these numbers shifting? Are we seeing? And of course, what I've heard is, it takes a while for them to build new facilities. Hopefully that's true. I always get worried when manufacturing headcount goes down for people who are working in existing manufacturing. That tells me that demand is slowing.
Is it wrong to say the two biggest, you could almost put it as farmers and manufacturing, people who work in manufacturing, some of probably Trump's biggest supporters or things that he leaned on the most was those workers, are feeling the heat more than anybody else really in the job market. And again, with costs in general, that's kind of what we've seen, I've seen the most, and farmers struggling. And apparently, I was reading an article, farmers already waste about 30% of all of the food that they make. And then again, with the crunch in costs and losing workers, just makes that obviously a little, that much harder for them.
Yeah, that's particularly true of agriculture. I mean, the meat processing industry somewhat less, but also is something like, I think, 15%. But definitely 30% for, for the harvesting, and what's actually gets on the market eventually. But the other thing is, the situation with beef in particular has to do with, some illnesses, among, animals, the sick cows we have here, that are in some of the other countries. But also the fact that many of the meat processing plants rely on immigrants who are in some cases undocumented, and they have now been kicked out of the country, many of them. So you have fewer people, processing the meat. It takes longer for that meat to get to the market, and therefore it's more expensive. And, oddly, here and there, you see Trump practically admitting this, by saying, for example, well, we're going to help Javier Milei in Argentina, which is, its largest food export is beef, and by giving him $20 billion to his party, we're going to, shore up his economy. That'll be good for everyone. It's actually, as it turns out, more like twice that much, but it's a bad look because you're giving a lot of money to another country and not directly to the American, people or the consumer. And then this is also this promise of, we're going to get all this inexpensive Argentinian beef. But it just smacks of desperation and kind of, damage control.
So here's a letter from Jay who says, when would you start seeing all this upheaval and uncertainty affect the stock market? Because people are very visual and being able to see gas prices and stock market numbers go down would really change public opinion. Which brings me almost perfectly to what I wanted to talk about next, was that stocks tumbling as an early rally gave way to what is being termed as tech anxiety. We can look at those as two different issues, but let us begin with the question that the listener posed, which is, when do we start to see that? Which I guess my follow-up would then be, are we not already seeing that?
Yeah, this is tricky because, as Heather so politely noticed, I was being boring and talking too much about numbers.
I didn't say you were boring. I've never said that.
that, you know, economists look at hard data like unemployment numbers, the percent of the unemployed that have been unemployed for 27 weeks or longer.
It was dry like crackers, not boring.
Yeah, you know, you know,
bond market, I like dry wine.
Treasury bill yields. But the average person primarily looks at grocery prices, gas prices, because those are inelastic purchases that are made every week. So they're, you know, they register psychologically much harder than other prices. But they also look to, the average person also looks to the stock market to get a sense of, you know, kind of as a bellwether of how the economy is performing. Now, that's completely rational for people who aren't diving into BLS numbers, aren't, you know, working directly with manufacturers, aren't, you know, involved in, you know, managing a business that has, you know, global supply chains. So to the letter writer's point, there's been a paradox that's been happening for the past 8 months or so, and that is we have – it's clear that our economy is getting weaker. Job growth is stalling to a halt. Wage growth is starting to slow. Inflation's up. Business investment is falling. Consumer and business confidence is down. But the stock market's booming. So how do you rationalize these two things? And now I'm just – I don't have an answer that I'm particularly confident of. So this is – one possibility, and that is the boom in stock indices has largely been driven by a handful of big tech firms, the Magnificent Seven. And even within those, you're looking at the giant boom in AI investment, right? NVIDIA chips, data centers, and that possibly could be essentially dragging the rest of the market up with it. And, you know, on Wednesday when NVIDIA reported their, you know, surprisingly large profit numbers or whatever, investors cheered. And then yesterday, markets went down. So the S&P is down 5% since its peak in late October. So to the letter writer's point is that I think we're starting to see the beginning of a correction. And this happens... This going back to the, if you want boring, put on your helmet, the late 18th century in England with the North Sea stock bubble, with the canal bond bubble in the U.S. in the 1830s and 1840s, with the quartering of the copper market bubble in the 1870s. Every financial crisis is preceded by somebody saying, well, this time it's different. Hmm. This technology is fundamentally going to change the world, the way the world works.
The dot-com bubble.
And some of those bubbles created real infrastructure, like the building of canals in the pre-railroad era, getting a lot of funding to the early tech companies. Hmm. And now we're seeing it with AI.
We have to take a break. I want to get to, I know Andrew wants to jump in, and we also have a lot of letters. Our listeners love the students. They love all of you. They really love the students. So great. We'll get to some more letters. We'll talk more about this and other topics and related topics. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we will continue this discussion after we get a news update from the BBC.
Give them a chance to live their lives and purify the land. People hear us through our voice, the world knows there's no...
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And got a good one going here on this Friday morning, the 21st of November, 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. And we have about 20, 25 minutes left with this terrific group and a lot to talk about and some other topics. We have some letters to get to. I will say one thing. This is a just an overall arching statement, but our listeners love our student guests, our Siena University guests. And so we thank you, and we thank them for being here. And we thank Dr. Vassitti for bringing them in. Andrew, you were wanting to make a point before we had to go to a break.
Yes, I had a quick comment for Dr. Vassitti. I was just wondering, when he referred to the AI bubble as a bubble and compared it to past bubbles, what would his comment be to Jerome Powell, who says that this isn't just a bubble like the dot-com bubble. These companies have earnings. There's actual money behind this, and this actually has huge implications on our GDP.
We usually preface it by saying the much maligned Jerome Powell.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, right, yeah. That's a good point. Sometimes the term bubble gets thrown around a little bit recklessly and therefore becomes devoid of meaning. And I probably should have referred to this as, you know, maybe the beginning of a market correction, because a bubble is when asset prices become unsupported by real fundamentals. Well, there are real fundamentals happening with AI, whether it's the chip production, whether it's the data center production, whether it's all or the data center construction and all of the downstream stuff. So there is real capacity being built that generates real earnings for these firms. The question becomes, that's a great question and a very appropriate clarification that I'm happy I had the opportunity to make. The question is that, you know, is this sustainable? And are we pouring too much into it? Businesses haven't quite figured out what to do with AI yet on a scale that would yield, economy-wide productivity gains, right? We're still in the, there's this thing out there. We know it can do some things, but I don't think you're seeing the mass adoption yet that would justify earnings and that these firms are making at the level they're making now, which is fundamentally different than a bubble.
I don't know if this would be right. So, like, this is kind of like a question for you, but like, with like the NVIDIA, like, and the AI bubble, we know that like the demand is like actually a thing, like it's real. Mm-hmm. But with the dot-com bubble, it was more like they thought that everyone was gonna like adopt these like buying habits online.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that goes back to that, you know, these were internet companies that had an idea.
Yeah, that's right.
But there was no, they had no earnings. There was no value to it.
Right.
Where these AI chips do have value. The question is, will this be adopted on such a large scale in a way that justifies the earnings? I think things are a little frothy. That's my own opinion. NVIDIA's PE ratio is 48 to 1, meaning their stock price ratio to a dollar of earnings is 48 times higher. The S&P average price to earnings ratio is 30. So, you know, NVIDIA is certainly above the average, and clearly they are the hot company making next generation chips. So you would expect them to be higher than the average. Whether this being higher than whether this exceptional performance is going to be sustainable, it's tough to see. One company can't drag along the U.S. economy to prosperity when we're facing giant tariff increases, deportations, a budget busting, tax cut, falling consumer confidence. So again, back to the letter writer's very simple but eloquent and important, eloquently stated and important question is that, you know, optimism can feed on itself. So can pessimism. And we might be seeing the beginning stages of that with what's been happening with some tech stocks.
All right, a couple letters here that we have. One is from David, who says, is there concern in the economics community that this administration is doing to labor statistics what they've done to Health and Human Services guidance?
Not yet, I don't think. President Trump did fire the former Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica McIntyre, who the BLS's methods are transparent. Their survey methods are transparent. They revise data. Trump didn't like the numbers. So, of course, it wasn't his policies that were to blame. It was the people reporting the numbers. Mm. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics, working in conjunction with the Census Bureau, has not altered their survey methodology. They have not altered their approach to collecting data. So, to my knowledge, looking up the current BLS commissioner's background, there's no evidence to suggest that the numbers are being fudged now.
Okay, follow-up question. Do you think Mark writes, do you think the good job numbers are attributable in part to the longer reporting period for employers due to the shutdown?
No, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics does two different surveys. There's the household survey where the unemployment numbers come from. That phone call was made to houses in the second week of the preceding month. So they called households in the second week of September. So that data was gathered. They survey employers to get the jobs numbers. Those surveys came in on time. The report was ready to go. But then the government shut down, so they couldn't release it. So to the letter writer's point, the current numbers I don't think are representative of any anomalies. I think what we might likely see is that future reports, particularly the November report, might end up perhaps being subject to revisions because of a longer reporting period and just the anomalies surrounding the shutdown.
All right. Questions for our students this morning and this from our listeners. And I will read them and you can answer however you see fit, folks. Here we go. One, let's go to this one. Laura says, I taught high school business courses for college credit in marketing, entrepreneurship, finance, economics, etc. for 33 years. I would observe that students would not choose these courses but then declare themselves business majors when applying for college. It always seemed like a strange disconnect. Can the students comment on their experiences? Is there something high schools can do to encourage students to explore these courses?
Well, in high school, we didn't have a lot of those business courses offered to me personally. So I honestly didn't know much about it. I didn't think that I would ever become a business major. If you had told my high school self that I'm an economics major, I would have laughed in your face probably. I really knew nothing about it. So I think offering more of these courses just to start and showing more career paths that you could take early on in high school would definitely be helpful for more people to explore it.
Yeah, and to kind of add on to what Kylie was saying, I kind of was the opposite. In high school, I had a lot of opportunities to take these business classes that were college credit accredited. And my recommendation would probably be to continue to push the fact that these are accredited classes and that you are getting 3 credits, maybe sometimes 4 credits for these classes, and encourage students who are looking to explore higher education to take the credits and take classes as any chance that they get in high school.
Yeah, kind of going with that, same experience for myself where my high school had a couple college credit classes to offer. I would really say, and what I would even, something I think about is for our professors and teachers is the harsh part for you guys is, or at least something, is you want to make sure you're giving the students something that would interest them. Mm. I think that's the biggest part going back to high school. Obviously, you teach them all different subjects, but I think it could be good to maybe allocate some more time of truly finding what is close to somebody's heart, what piques somebody's interest, going by students and really seeing what they're really passionate about. And I think we get them a lot more excited for the future and just be open to trying things. That's the biggest thing. Trying to be, when you're young, it's something for yourself you want to be able to do. And then it's, again, for teachers and professors. It's just a quick comment thing. Be like, I hope you guys as students and everybody who's younger, and I tell my little brother this now as a senior in high school, be open to everything and try everything, and trying to just be a good role model from there. But there's so much out there to try and learn.
Okay.
My high school, they did offer the college classes, but a lot of them weren't the business type of classes. They were more like history or science, kind of just like the prereqs to get your freshman or sophomore year credits out of the way. So I think if, obviously Micah and Andrew, they had more of those classes offered than my high school did. So just offering more of these specialized classes, but also just to go off what Micah said, trying new things. Like I said, I would have never thought that I would have been interested in economics because I didn't know much about it until I did, before I declared my economics major, I did exploring business when I got to college. So that kind of like allows you to get a feel for everything, see what you like, see what classes you like. And that's where I found my interest. So just like really pushing yourself out there to try new things that you don't know much about.
Laura, that's a great question. Thank you very much, and great answers from our group. Another question from Steve in Austerlitz. He was struck by the fact that you're all seniors and said, what do you all and your classmates think about your own prospects as you get ready to graduate in just a few short months?
Hopeful. Maybe a little grim. Unemployment.
Well, which is it?
Unemployment being at an all-time high.
That was my
last
first
4 years.
Book,
was maybe
hopeful and grim.
Yeah,
yeah.
maybe is not the best thing. We read, or at least I read recently, that college graduates are really struggling to find jobs after graduating. I know a lot of my classmates are also finding or are taking masters, and I wonder if they're going into masters just because they're delaying entering the job market. It's
No, did you say you were going into
master's? I'm not going into master's. I'm hopefully not going into a master's. But again, it's it kind of becomes that point where it's are you getting a master's because you really like something, or you're really interested in something, or are you getting a master's because you can't find a job and you just don't really know what to do?
Yeah, I would definitely say, and I think kind of what Andrew was mentioning, what I was trying to read up on earlier, is I think the recent college graduate unemployment rate is right now at like 9.1%. And it kind of, again, going with what we were saying earlier, is as much as we want to see AI succeed and everything and do well, I can't help but think in the back of my head, as well as I wanted to do, it's the same jobs that it's taking that we're trying to go for right now. So it's definitely going to be interesting to getting out of college. I think you just got to, just trying to take it all in, though, really. Just, it is what it is. Not really going to be upset with it or anything. I see that there's things I would like to be better, but, there's no reason to just try and fight it. It's just, it's not really where the fight's at. But it's in this competitive market with other students, it's obviously all great to see, seeing people getting educated. It's obviously the bar is higher and higher if you really want to be competitive coming out into the job market when you're young. So I think it's going to be interesting over the next couple of years to see what colleges do with how the job market's become. And for myself, definitely excited for it. I'm going to hope for the best but really excited though. And I can't believe the words graduation are, I'm talking about that now, because it's like, 4 years ago, I didn't think I'd be, really in this chair now. Just I wasn't really actually thinking about how I'd be graduating college, and now it's here.
Yeah. Well, and that's very exciting. Kylie.
I was just kind of going to go off of what Andrew said earlier about how he's been reading a lot about people starting their masters because it's hard to find a job right now.
Right.
I think that's definitely like a possibility. We've been told now is a really great time to continue your education because it is so hard to find a job. But I think that going into your master's is also a way to expand your experiences more as it is becoming more and more competitive. So getting more experience under your belt could help people. But I do think that a lot of people are definitely staying in higher education because it is really hard to find a job right now.
How's higher education going, Aaron?
They're higher ed's facing a lot of headwinds from demographic challenges and declining, slowing enrollment growth numbers. It's a tricky world out there. The fact that the labor market is starting to slow and perhaps stall, businesses are leery of hiring too many people given the uncertainty of the tariffs and the declining consumer confidence. So it's tricky. I don't think it's certainly not. I mean, it's better than entering the labor market in 2009 following the financial crisis, where you just had an implosion of an extraordinary number of firms. So it's this is what Kylie said earlier. This a good word to describe the current situation is just uncertain.
Yeah.
There's really no way to predict one way or the other how things are going to go and whether it's going to be easy or tough to get a job. There's so many different variables at play.
I mean, I think that there is a sense in some industries and informational parts of the market that there are limits to AI. I mean, its usefulness. I mean, obviously AI is going to continue to develop, become more sophisticated, but that it's a tool. You know, it is to the wooden plow. You know, the automated thresher is. You know, I mean, it's not going to necessarily replace people, but the market will change. You know, and some new categories of work will be created. You know, there will be losses. But I mean, I know that in education, there's already what I'm seeing is that there's increasing skepticism about the usefulness of AI. Even though when I was at Middlebury this summer, there was a very weird experiment where we had a guest lecturer who came and spoke in Russian, and he had an AI companion who spoke, you know, impeccable Moscow accented Russian, and you know, he said, you know, create a poem, the mixture of these two writers, like one from the 18th century, one from the 20th. And, you know, the AI came up with it. But you could just tell that it was very derivative. And this doesn't exclude the possibility of increasing sophistication, you know, obviously. But I think that there is a sense in which, you know, AI is with us, but that it's, you know, it might increasingly fall into specific niches in terms of its use value.
I was going to say, I mean, as, you know, the employers that I talk to, a couple things I would say. Number one, AI is a tool.
Yeah.
And more, it's the ability to use the tool is going to be an asset. You know, when, I'm old enough to remember when people didn't always have a computer on their desk at work. Hmm. And when we went from straight word processing to actually using computers for things like, I don't know, email. Ooh, scary. Hmm. There were people who resisted, who didn't want change, and there were the people who embraced it. And they end up rising to the top of, you know, sort of the workplace because they're the ones who know how to use this stuff. Hmm. Eventually, everyone will get there, I think. But the thing that I liked to hear from the students here is that they've had some work experiences during college, because the employers that I talk to will tell you there's nothing more valuable than someone who's actually worked during college and had a workplace experience. Because college is it's not, you know, you wake up at 7:30, brush your teeth, put on your suit, go to the office and work until 4 p.m., right? It's class here, class there. Having someone who's got an experience of what it's like to get up, be at a job all day, or even work from home all day, that's different. And those, the internship model is something that's going to explode. Mm-hmm. And the colleges that embrace that, the colleges and universities that embrace that are going to be the go-to places.
I will just point out that this program being produced today and by Madeline Reynolds, who was an intern. And, you know, the great interns are the ones who come in and then they tell you that they're done on May 4th. And you say, you can't leave. You have to come back. And you realize that over that period of time, you've relied on them and they do the job you want them to do. So just
started really in the legislature as an assembly intern and now I'm stuck in Albany forever working in politics.
We don't want you stuck.
Yeah. It was a great experience. It made me realize that I really like the sausage making of government. Basically, like, how do you make laws? How do you take problems and solve them with policies or make policies that are really bad and how do you undo them? The experience is something that makes you realize that you might not have been interested in something, but once you're in it and you were saying, you know, taking classes in college, you realize, wow, this is way more interesting than I ever would have thought. But having a context, a practical context, is everything. Sitting in a class talking about state government, I never would have wanted to work there. I mean, the books are so boring.
Yes. Kylie.
Just to stem off of what you were saying, like, you can sit in class and you can learn the concepts and the models behind everything, but having actual experience to, like, apply it to real-world settings is, like, I think really where you learn. And even on the other side of it, you could also learn what you don't like. You might think you like it, and then you might have an internship or an experience, and you're like, oh, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. So it really is just a learning experience that teaches you a lot, I think.
Micah?
Yeah, I would say entering now as well, I would say it's honestly one of the most humbling experiences as well. I enjoy learning. It's kind of almost, as I'll put it, as one of my hobbies. And even now interning, I've tried to do a lot preparing for it wise. But as I'm doing this, as I realize there's so much more out there to learn. And it's the people skills, more or less, are one of them. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think interning, I definitely obviously is going to be really, really big in the future. And I'd go with maybe like AI programs in college too. I think that'll be really cool. Like you were saying, I used to try and say to some of my professors who were obviously a little more open to AI, I try to tell people, it's like, I'd rather get good with AI so I can't be taken by AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good way of putting it.
And just trying to build off that. But it's definitely, exciting future ahead.
And you seemed, when you were talking about your experiences that with data, that it's something you greatly enjoy.
Oh yeah, absolutely. With my current internship, I mean, I started as an intern with the SUNY Research Foundation in compliance, and it wasn't something that I wanted to do or what I was looking to do. It was just an opportunity where you just can't say no. You got to say yes to everything that comes in front of you. I said yes, and now I'm working in with data, where it's a lot more of what I like to do and more my realm. So just being able to grow internally with the SUNY Research Foundation from an internship has been awesome, and everything I've learned, I really love it.
And plus, they have an awesome board, right?
Oh, yeah.
You were thinking that the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Talk about the SUNY Research, a little bit about the group.
It's a nonprofit. It is not actually part of SUNY. But New York is somewhat unique in that we have really great research institutions in the state, and they apply for and receive funding for projects. Mm. And so the Research Foundation basically does all the administrative back end of the grant process of making sure that, NIH funding comes in for a specific project, SRF takes that, and the people who work on it end up, in many instances, becoming SUNY Research Foundation employees. Maybe it's temporary, right, on campuses. But, in a huge system like the SUNY system, it's really good to have this arm that is basically managing the research funding and the administration of the funding. I could tell you more, but, obviously it's highly secretive. No, I'm just kidding.
You don't want to get into Aaron territory? I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. It has been a great show, and I really so appreciate Kylie and Micah and Andrew. We wish you all the luck in the world, especially from the fact that you are going out into the world. Maybe you can bring them back before they graduate. Can you do that? Yeah, that'd be fine.
If they want to.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be a totally different market here, I'm sure, in a couple months. So it'll be interesting to talk about. No.
Everything will be different.
Yeah. Everything will be perfect.
Yeah.
All be fixed. It'll be great.
It'll finally have kicked in.
It'll be great. We'd love to get you right before you graduate again. That'd be wonderful. Thank you very much. Thanks, of course, Heather, Aaron, and Alexander. You all are wonderful.
Thank you.
It. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be right back.